You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a production of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and today my guest is the author of an important new book that explores the economic transformation and fallout experienced by many communities throughout the nation, but especially here in the Midwest. And the story told in this book has applications to communities right here in our listening area. He's Gabriel Winant, and his book is called The Next Shift: The Fall of Industry and the Rise of Healthcare in Rust Belt America. Gabriel, and thanks so much for taking the time to be on.
Thank you for having me. Nice to join you.
As someone who's been looking at this issue a lot over the last 7 years since my show began, I'm surprised something like this wasn't written earlier, because it's got such enormous implications for our area here as we see the transformation of our economy. So you're an assistant professor of history at the University of Chicago. What was it that first led you into investigating this very, very timely topic?
Well, you know, I grew up in Philadelphia, and Philadelphia, like many cities, you know, around the country now, has a story that it likes to tell about itself. That, you know, it used to be an industrial town, just like cities all across the North and Midwest, and it traded in those jobs at some point for, they often describe it as eds and meds, which is education and medicine. And, you know, this has kind of been marketed as an urban renewal strategy, a way to attract young, educated, creative people, you know, a vision of a kind of post-industrial kind of gleaming metropolis. You know, all the grimy stuff is gone now, and we can just, you know, drink lattes and whatever. And, you know, growing up in Philly, I could see, you can see with your naked eye, right? That there's some nice new buildings around University of Pennsylvania campus and whatever, but whatever jobs people are working here, they're not all doctors and computer programmers. And I went to graduate school at Yale University, which is in New Haven, and heard the same story again, right? New Haven used to be the center of Winchester manufacturing, as, you know, rifle production. None of that's there anymore. And the university and the hospital, again, people said, okay, the city is having a renaissance around this. And you can see really stark social, economic, racial inequality. So I could tell there were people caught up in this change, thousands and thousands of people in any one city, who the story didn't really seem to encompass. And I wanted to understand, what is the bottom half of this post-industrial eds and meds economy? Where did it come from? Why is it as large? Is it as large as it kind of seems to be? And how did that happen?
For listeners out there, why this is important to our area, this is spot on with what's occurred in our region here in the Quad Cities, for example. I did some independent research, and Rock Island and Scott counties both had manufacturing jobs in the 30% of total jobs back in the 1970s. Now, manufacturing is still number one, but not by much. Healthcare is really close and will probably be overtaking it here soon. So this is a very relevant topic. The center of your the story you tell in this book, which is just an excellent book, is Pittsburgh, which you know, we debate whether it's in the Midwest. I kind of think it is, especially the western part of Pennsylvania.
I agree. I think it's Midwest.
But that seems like an interesting choice. You talked about Philadelphia, but what led you to Pittsburgh? Is that more of just, it's a great example of the eds and meds economy?
Yeah, well, Pittsburgh, I had never been there, actually, before I decided to do research on it. But, you know, it obviously was a famous center for a particular core industry in American manufacturing, which was steel. U.S. Steel was based there. The United Steelworkers of America were based there. The Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO, which, you know, is now part of the AFL-CIO, was, you know, originally founded there. So it had this deep industrial history, but it also had this really prominent new healthcare sector and post-industrial kind of apparently renaissance and revival. And this, you know, it was very clear even symbolically. The tallest building on the Pittsburgh skyline is U.S. Steel Tower. It was built in the 60s to be the headquarters of the steel company. And, you know, today the biggest tenant is the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. And so they took the USS, U.S. Steel, the letters off the top of the tower, and they put UPMC up there, right? The new game in town kind of got to display itself. But, you know, also just from the perspective of a historian, because Pittsburgh was the center of the kind of flagship industry of what we often call the Second Industrial Revolution, starting in the 1880s, that's, you know, age of steel and rail, skyscrapers, this kind of thing. It was a place that stood in for the social problems of industrial capitalism for a long time and got really heavily studied and examined, and people were always going there to do research. And what a historian looks for when you're going to do a research project is records. You know, what have people found in the past? What have they saved? And Pittsburgh had really good records of 100 years of economic history for me.
Well, I can tell you, I've done some of my own research, and I also teach part-time, where you look at city reinvention. And if you Google that, Pittsburgh comes up number one, and it portrays the story, as you mentioned. It almost provides the narrative of a seamless transition from manufacturing to healthcare and education, and how. But your book is an important historical document in showing how that road took place, but it was anything if but planned. What I really like is how you talk about the role that the factory played, not just in the economy, but in a way of life in Pittsburgh, which I think was true everywhere.
Yeah. Well, it's important to understand that industrial work, you know, when in the 1930s and 1940s, in the age of the New Deal, for a complicated set of reasons, industrial work became the main point of access to economic security and what we can call social citizenship for the working class. Social citizenship meaning inclusion in all the kinds of social support that citizenship was increasingly coming to mean, things like social security, access to home ownership, healthcare, retirement. Industrial work in the private sector, you know, unionized industrial work, became the main way that the working class population as a whole could get access to that. If a family member, typically a husband slash father, could get a job in a unionized factory, that his whole family would get covered by his health insurance, right? And his wages would in theory pay enough for them all to live off of. This wound up implicating whole families in what you describe as a kind of industrial way of life. And in the book, I talk about, you know, for example, how in steelworker households in Pittsburgh, you know, men would often work changing shifts. The mills ran 24 hours a day. You can't turn them off because they're too hot. You need to keep them hot. So that meant that very often their wives would get used to cooking two dinners, for example, you know, one for the kids and then one for the husband when he got home at midnight or whatever. Kids grow up with stories about, you know, or tell stories of when they were growing up about how the house had to be dark and quiet all day because, you know, dad was working the night shift and so he had to be asleep during the day. So the whole population is kind of tied up, caught up in what's happening at the mill.
That's changed so much. And the story you told about the child who, when they smelled what was it, something in onions at night, that meant all was well because dad was home from work.
Yeah, grilled cheese and onions.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's interesting because somebody from a working class household, I kind of lived through that myself. What's really interesting, what goes throughout this book is the idea of economic security, which you mentioned, and of course unions fought hard to achieve benefits, including health care, that was built up and created what you call it, it was a contribution to creating a more fragmented health care system. So it had definitely for those people some positive implications, but for those without the insurance, it kind of led, with the lack of a national health care plan, it led to this fragmentation in the healthcare marketplace.
That's right. So, you know, in the 1930s and 1940s, when Social Security was created and, you know, various other kind of basic social programs were established, there was an idea that this was going to lead naturally to some kind of socialized health insurance program, what we would today call Medicare for All. Harry Truman tried to do this after Roosevelt died and Truman became president. He tried to do this in the late 40s. Didn't work out for a complicated set of reasons. And, you know, the main backers that he had in that effort had been the big industrial unions, the United Auto Workers, the United Steel Workers, United Electrical Workers, United Mine Workers, etc. when they saw the writing on the wall that this wasn't going to work out, they said, you know, we better negotiate our own plans. Right? We better get our employers to insure us and our members and their families through the private sector. And this, in the late 1940s and early 1950s, this is really when employment-based health insurance dates back to. I mean, it pre-exists this in certain ways, but this is how it really becomes a widespread institution, was this compromise that was sort of forced onto these unions, but then established a link between your job and your health care. As you say, this created a kind of insider-outsider dynamic, right? If you were a working-class person and you had a job in a steel mill or an auto plant, or you were married to someone or the child of someone or otherwise dependent of someone who had a job like that, then you had what was increasingly this really good insurance, typically through Blue Cross, although it could be other things too. In the steel industry, it was Blue Cross. But, you know, that caused the price of healthcare to start to rise. And what we think of now is this kind of permanent, you know, healthcare costs just go up and up and up every year. That really kind of started to take off for the first time in the 50s because there were these new working class mass markets for healthcare. And so it created this gap between people who had these jobs and people who didn't.
One thing that I thought was really fascinating that you pointed out was, and I meant to write the page down and I forgot, but the line blurred between the working class and the middle class and this idea of class identification in our society. Folks were doing so well that the traditional definition of middle class seemed to kind of meld into what was regarded as middle class. And I think that's important in how people see themselves and how they fit into this American economy and the American dream.
Yeah, you know, this was a very common idea in the 50s and 60s that the blue-collar worker was disappearing into the middle class because, you know, again, if you were a steel worker, or you were an auto worker, you had it so relatively good compared to your father. Mm-hmm. If he had been in that same industry, for example, that, you know, maybe you didn't have a distinct set of class interests anymore and a different distinct class position. I tend to be a little skeptical of that, actually. And the reason is that, right away, starting from the late 1950s, basically as soon as the Korean War was over, you can see the writing on the wall in the long term for industrial work. Looking back historically, you can see the way that this was already kind of getting hit with the threat of automation, the threat of offshoring. Every decade, there were fewer steelworkers, fewer auto workers than there had been a decade before. And, you know, this shows up in everyday life for blue-collar workers, right, as they spend a whole year maybe getting laid off and recalled, and they're working four-day weeks and different things like this. They're on strike all the time to defend, you know, different parts of their contract. And, you know, we think of job loss in manufacturing as really starting to hit in the late 70s and 80s, and it certainly accelerated then. But people were starting to get hit with it already in the 50s and 60s. And, you know, I think that creates this kind of paradox where you both have individual workers who never had it so good, and yet for big groups of blue-collar people or working-class people, the access to this kind of work is starting to dry up.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson. And my guest today is Assistant Professor of History at University of Chicago, Gabriel Winant, who's the author of an incredibly timely and good book for those interested in what's been going on in our economy, in our region and across the country over the past 50 years. It's called The Next Shift, The Fall of Industry and the Rise of Healthcare in Rust Belt America. Very, very relevant to our area as well, as I've talked about. We've talked so far about how Gabriel took an interest in this topic and wrote about it. We've been covering some of the history of manufacturing jobs and how they started to whittle away, starting in the 1960s, 1970s. Of course, it accelerated. Very interesting. And again, I don't see this very often in all the reading I do, the connection between the decline of manufacturing jobs and the rise of healthcare. You started touching on that a little bit with the fragmented healthcare system, but it's really interesting to me how we talk about wanting healthcare jobs, and sure, they sound good, but as this transition took place, it was really kind of a bifurcated job market in healthcare that doesn't seem to me that it's focused on enough.
That's right. So I was mentioning earlier that you have this kind of uneven distribution of economic security. There's insiders, even within the working class, there are insiders, people who have unionized blue-collar jobs with all the protections that that brings. And then there's kind of outsiders. And, you know, famously, labor law, Social Security Act, these things didn't cover domestic workers when they were passed. They didn't cover agricultural workers. And to a significant degree, they didn't cover healthcare workers. And, you know, these are jobs that were mainly done, were disproportionately done by women, by people of color. And it's important to understand in the case of healthcare, the whole industry gets kind of built up, as I was saying a moment ago, as an adjunct to industrial work, right? You have, like, to take any given steel town outside of Pittsburgh, there's a steel mill and there's the 5,000-6,000 guys who work there and their families, and they have health insurance through their jobs at the steel mill, you know, bargained by the union. And then across the street from the steel mill is the hospital for the town. And, you know, who is the market for that hospital? It's all those steel workers and their families who have that good health insurance, right? They're who is keeping that hospital afloat. Yep. And then the people who work at that hospital are the women who maybe their husbands couldn't get a job at the steel mill or got laid off or something like this. But for one reason or another, they need to generate more income. So they're disproportionately likely to be African-American women in Pittsburgh because African-American men generally were kind of last hired, first fired from the steel mill. They're more economically marginal, and they're standing outside of that kind of protected circle, and they have to take care of the people who are inside of it. So healthcare workers, they didn't have the right to form a union under federal law until the 1970s. They weren't protected by minimum wage law until the late 1960s. And, you know, even once those things changed, the pattern was kind of already set, that this work, you know, was seen as a kind of labor of love. It's something that you do out of the goodness of your heart. It's not really part of the economy as people understood it, in the same way that making steel and making cars was.
And these trends, which we're so familiar with in this area, of the decline of manufacturing, job loss, or population loss, the brain drain of young people leaving, and that leaves an older population, which is more dependent on healthcare, and feeds this cycle of more spending on healthcare, more need, which you document in the book very well.
That's exactly right. So when deindustrialization really starts to get bad, it changes the fabric of the population. It gives you a population that's older, as you said, both because young people are leaving, but also because there had been this big pulse of investment in manufacturing capacity in the 40s and 50s for the wars in those times. So after the Korean War ended, like I was saying before, the cohort who worked in the steel mill was never fully replaced. That cohort, you know, the guys, like, they were all retired by the 1970s, 1980s, by which time the workforce as a whole is much smaller. There aren't as many opportunities for young men, especially men. So young men in particular tend to leave town entirely. Population shrinks. Population also gets sicker, both because it's getting older and also because a big economic shock makes the population sicker. You know, this is a pretty well-documented phenomenon, right, that when there's large-scale job loss and rapidly increasing impoverishment, which is what happens when you have a wave of plant shutdowns, right, it increases stress, blood pressure, alcoholism, all kinds of things. It takes a real toll on people's bodies. And so the population is older and it's sicker and it's poorer. But one thing that they still kind of have, more at least than they have other kinds of social support, is access to healthcare. For different reasons having to do with the design of healthcare and health insurance institutions, those tend to kind of survive some of that economic turmoil a little bit better than other kinds of social support. And so they grow, right? Because the people have all of this need, and this is the one thing that's there for them. You know, I mentioned in the book at one point that in a few of the kind of relatively smaller steel towns just south of Pittsburgh in the Monongahela Valley, just in one year in the 1980s when things were at rock bottom, the steel worker retiree benefit plan pumps over $120 million into the local economy, just a couple small towns. So it's actually this real stream of income around which the whole economy starts to reorient.
And you've got that now in rural areas. I know your focus was on you know, the bigger metro areas like Pittsburgh and what we're talking about here. But in where I live in rural areas, the hospital is one of the major employers, and the fear of the hospital closing not only has healthcare ramifications, but economic, you know, is losing the major employer.
Oh, yeah. Well, so today, healthcare and social assistance, that's a category in the census, category of employment, the largest sector of employment in the country. It's 14% of all jobs in the country. And in places where manufacturing has historically been very important, that healthcare number tends to be even larger. Not just it's true in big cities, through, you know, New York and Philadelphia and so on, but it's also true in a lot of smaller or rural industrial or formerly industrial towns where these same dynamics played out.
And again, we talk about, you know, these jobs, there's lots of jobs, doctors, nurses, technicians, but overall you talk about this some in the book, but what is kind of the structure of the healthcare marketplace, the jobs that are involved in healthcare, and how they break out as far as salary and benefits and unionization?
Well, it's very stratified. So it's true, there are these good-paying jobs at the top, doctors especially, and, you know, registered nurses, and you get through, you know, 4 years of school and become an RN. Even some so-called paraprofessional jobs as technicians can be, you know, somewhat decent paying, although, yeah, I wouldn't want to overstate it. But, you know, a lot of those you have to go to school, maybe incur some debt to get into. And meanwhile, there are huge ranks of, you know, CNAs, right, certified nursing assistants, is a really rapidly growing category of job. Home health aides, obviously, is one of the fastest growing categories of job in the country. It has been for a long time now. These are the big occupational subgroups within the healthcare workforce, and the ones that are growing really fast. And, you know, people tend to be paid $10, $11, $12 an hour. They tend to be non-union. And even when they are unionized, I have to say, I mean, I'm a very strong supporter of all workers unionizing. But, you know, there are real limits that exist for what unions have been able to win for workers in these industries because healthcare itself is so heavily privatized. So very often it's the public that's footing the bill in one form or another, especially in things like nursing homes and home healthcare. It's Medicaid very often that's paying. Even for hospitals, though, Medicare and Medicaid are, you know, huge, by far the most important payers. But you have these private actors, right? Hospitals, private insurers, sometimes they kind of get in the middle and are skimming something off the top, basically, for themselves, and put really severe downward pressure on wages and on staffing levels that make these jobs, which are the kinds of jobs that we seem to need. They're what we have demand for, but they make them really difficult jobs economically and also kind of physically and emotionally.
On a personal level, I've seen the work that these nurses, assistants, CNAs do, home healthcare nurses, they're doing, I mean, they're doing God's work, the nurses in nursing homes. And yeah, they're not paid much. That's difficult physical work.
It's very high injury rates. I mean, this year, I think it has had the highest rate of, you know, workplace mortality for obvious reasons of any job in the country.
Do you sense any change in collective attitudes towards these people since the onset of COVID and the work that they do in helping especially the elderly get by on a day-to-day basis when families couldn't be there to help them?
Well, I think there's a paradox here. So if you ask, in my experience, if you ask just about any healthcare worker in the last year, what do you think of the phrase essential worker? They laugh at you because, you know, people have been called essential, but they've been treated like they're disposable.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a bitter irony. It's a bitter insult for people who, you know, it's not that they don't know the value of their own work. Of course they do. And of course, you know, many of the patients and their families also do, as you're saying. But the institutions that exist to, you know, sustain this work, I think really make a mockery of that in terms, again, of the wages and the working conditions that people are forced to endure. Now, I'm a historian, so I talk about the past, and I'm always reluctant to talk about the future. But I think my hope is that this experience of, you know, our collective dependence on these workers, which existed before the pandemic. We already were depending on healthcare workers to keep our society together, to keep us alive, right, before the pandemic. But this year we've had this collective experience of that dependency that we all share on healthcare workers being made really explicit and really visible. And my hope is that that is going to cash out into the form of more power and more, you know, rights and protections and collective voice for those workers, which, you know, will have to come from them. But I think, you know, if there is an opportunity for healthcare workers to make their voice heard, they'll take it.
Your final chapter, and we just have like a minute left here, and I don't mean to be unfair and ask a long question with a long answer and force you into a limited time frame, but you talk about the two forces colliding in healthcare, the bottomless demand and then a resistance to spending more, especially on the poor, and it plays out at three levels. I'm curious about the political, institutional, and the daily lives of healthcare workers. But in the political realm, talk about that, if you can, just sum up that for our listeners and how this is playing out right now.
Yeah, well, we all know, right, that healthcare is this, like, ongoing nightmare in American politics. For, you know, most of my, I'm 34, for most of my lifetime, it's been something that we're having this endless debate about. You know, we sometimes kind of come up with new solutions for it, some bills pass or whatever, but they tend to kind of recreate the problems in new forms. And in particular, the growth of costs, right? This is the main way that we talk about healthcare in our politics, is that cost growth is this huge problem, which it is, but cost growth is also the thing that makes it so hard to solve politically, because, you know, your dollar of cost is someone else's dollar of income in the healthcare system. And because we have stood healthcare in as one of our main social solutions for rising inequality and deindustrialization and the loss of that economic security, that inefficiency is also playing this perverse political function of keeping economically declining communities alive, which we want to do. It's just that the healthcare system may not be the best way of doing that. That's what makes it so hard to reform, and why our kind of illogical and privatized and profiteering system has been so resistant to a kind of more rational system, potentially, where the public, like Harry Truman tried to do, where the public was in charge of this, you know, and we could decide democratically how to allocate our resources.
Well, the book is really must reading. I didn't, as all good interviews of authors go, I didn't get to nearly all the questions I had, but there's a lot more in here, and I really want to urge my listeners to take a look at this. It's called The Next Shift, The Fall of Industry and the Rise of Healthcare in Rust Belt America, Key Lessons for Our Area and Across the Entire Country. The author, Gabriel Winant, has been my guest today. Gabe, thanks so much for being my guest.
Thanks for having me.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at WVIK.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.